here on one case today. The panel for this particular case is to my left, Justice Brian Walker, to my right, the inestimable Dabney Basil, and then my name is Wade Birdwell, and I just happen to have been around longer than both of these guys, so that makes me the head justice on this particular panel. So anyway, if you would be so kind as to call the case, we'll get going. Thank you.
The court will now call City of Arlington versus Craig Taylor. The man please the court, Mr. Joshua Skinner to argue for the appellant, and Mr. Matthew Keita to argue for the appellant.
May it please the court. Joshua Skinner for the City of Arlington. We're requesting that the court reverse and render a decision in favor of the city on this case on the basis of governmental immunity. The Texas Tort Claims Act creates a very limited waiver of governmental immunity that doesn't cover the specific accident that was involved in this. It was an accident at an intersection where Mr. Craig Taylor crashed into the vehicle officer Benaja Baskin as he was en route to an emergency. The Tort Claims Act creates a very limited waiver, but then it also creates additional further limitations within it. This fits within one of those further limitations of the waiver of governmental immunity. So it's Civil Practice of Remedies Code 101.055, subsection 2, dealing with emergency response. And ultimately, the city is entitled to governmental immunity because, first of all, Officer Baskin was responding to an emergency. That's undisputed in the case. It had lights and sirens on as well. It's also undisputed that Officer Baskin was acting in compliance with the laws and ordinances applicable to emergency action. And we believe that the evidence establishes as a matter of law that Officer Baskin's actions were not taken with conscious disregard, indifference, or reckless disregard for the safety of others. It's undisputed that Officer Baskin slowed down as he approached and went into the intersection. Mr. Taylor, however, contends that Officer Baskin was reckless because he did not come to a complete stop before entering into the intersection.
Is there a difference between slowing down and an intersection that is free of any other obstructions and one that has obstructions one way or the other? In other words, if I slow down, okay, I understand the case law says slowing down is sufficient, but if I'm slowing down behind an 18-wheeler and then I just pop out from behind the 18-wheeler, isn't that a different standard? And isn't that something that makes it factually something that a fact finder would have to make a determination of?
Your Honor, it would be different if it dealt with a situation where the officer had not made an attempt to scan the area to look for, to be sure that it, to see if it was clear, which Officer Baskin did in this case. He's coming up to the intersection. He looks around, sees cars stopped, various different locations, has his lights and sirens going. There's always a risk, as I think it was the first Court of Appeals put it, that there's always a risk of there being some sort of obstruction. There have been several cases that have specifically dealt with that issue of obstructions that partially obscured the vision of the officer or the emergency responder as they were going through. But that's really why the statute expects, as the normal rule, as Officer Baskin did here, that he'll have his lights and sirens on. It creates the obligation on the civilian drivers to be paying closer attention because there's necessarily a risk involved with responding to emergency situations. The calculation that the legislature has made is that we want those emergency responders to get to those emergencies as quickly as possible. So slowing down, yeah. Looking around to see if it appears that it's clear, yes. Having lights and sirens on, those are all important things and very helpful, all of which Officer Baskin did in this case. So it's not a situation where he is jumping out without having an opportunity to look at the intersection. If you look at the video, you can see it does appear that everybody stopped as he's going into the intersection.
Do you know of any case law, I guess, I think what Justice Birdwell was asking is there a distinction at all in the case law where you have an intersection that's totally clear, you have one vehicle and another vehicle, and as opposed to a situation where the vehicle has to slow down because there's another vehicle in front of it. I think that's kind of the the question. In other words, they're not slowing down because they're actually yielding and being safe. They're slowing down because for a split second they have to because there's a vehicle in front of it, and then they take off.
Because the record reflects he went around, and he actually went into the oncoming lane because there was traffic in the ongoing lane. And so slowing down to make that maneuver would constitute slowing down before entering the intersection. But as Justice Walker's talking about, that's a different type of slowing down than coming to the intersection free and clear, slowing down, et cetera.
Yeah, so if you have a situation where the going around those vehicles was in some way connected to a failure to look at the intersection, I don't think that issue has come up in any of the case law, but that doesn't fit with this situation. The cars that he went around were to his right, and the car that ultimately runs into him was off to the left. So those cars in no way were the obstruction that prevented him from seeing Mr. Taylor's car. The car that apparently, that made it where Officer Baskin couldn't see Mr. Taylor's car was a car that was stopped at the intersection as it was supposed to be on the eastbound traffic. And so it was a car that was going the same direction as Mr. Taylor, not a car that was going the same direction as Officer Baskin. And so those cars that are stopped there on the northbound road that Officer Baskin's going along aren't in any way interfering with his ability to be able to see the traffic. Now, there are cases that involve other kinds of obstructions. There were several of them, a couple out of the First Court of Appeals and one out of the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals. And in all of those cases, the court said, even with the obstruction, it's not reckless if the officer is slowing down, looking as is able to, taking into account the fact that there is this obstruction. It's not going to make it perfect. It's not going to make it a perfect vision. But you don't have a situation where the officer knows of the danger and doesn't care. And that's really, I think, the way this court has described it, knew the relevant facts but did not care about the result. And a number of the courts have said, well, the fact that the officer had lights and sirens on and slowed down and scanned the intersection, those are all factors that establish as a matter of law that the officer was not acting with conscious indifference or reckless disregard for the safety of others.
Now, did Officer Ramirez decide that our officer hadn't acted with due care or operated his vehicle without due care?
Officer Ramirez was concerned that there might have been negligence in regards to this situation. She ultimately concluded that was not the case when she was part of the panel that evaluated the full, with all the evidence and having all the benefit of being able to sit down and really look through the video, and having the statements from it would have been like the witness, the civilian witness who was there, and having all the information involved. At that point, in her police report, she noted she was concerned that that might be the case. But even if that was the case, even if Officer Baskin did act without due care, that would merely show negligence.
Rodriguez didn't have the benefit of the cam from the video, did he? Or did he?
Ramirez?
Ramirez, I'm sorry.
At the scene, it appears that probably when she was doing her report, she'd had some opportunity to view it at least partially. I think that's the way her police report indicates, that maybe she'd looked at something in the video. But it would have been the dash cam, and she might have just done that in his vehicle. I don't think there's any evidence in the record about that. I don't think that part of her deposition's in the record. But she certainly would have had the opportunity to review all of the evidence, as all the panelists did when the accident review board, the crash review board, reviewed the situation.
So, in essence, what you're saying is, negligence is one thing, and then whether or not they exercise the due care in order to destroy immunity is a whole different thing. Those are not the same things. They're apples and oranges, correct?
Yeah, negligence is insufficient here. It has to have been the conscious indifference or reckless disregard.
But I'm curious, in your brief, you did talk about some of the fault of Mr. Taylor, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that goes to negligence. That doesn't really go to whether or not the officer exercised due care. Don't you agree with that?
Mr. Taylor's negligence in the situation, and that he was in violation of the law when he went through that intersection.
But it really has nothing to do with whether or not the officer exercised due care.
No, that doesn't have to do with whether the officer was acting with conscious indifference or reckless disregard. That's correct.
So, just out of curiosity, and it's been a bit since I've read your brief, but what was the point in bringing up Taylor's negligence in the brief?
The point of bringing up his negligence was just merely the fact that his going through the intersection was a violation of the law. So this isn't a situation where Mr. Taylor's was entirely unconnected to the events. It's not a surprise that you might have an accident that would occur.
Is there anything in the record to indicate he even received a ticket?
Oh, I don't believe they gave him a ticket.
For violating the law that you're talking about in your brief.
No, but it's not disputed that he says he didn't hear it, and I at this point we're certainly taking him at his word. I mean, we're not disputing on appeal that he did not hear the sirens or see the lights. I mean, that's not one of the points that we're arguing. He has an obligation to, and some of the case law points out this fact that I think the Supreme Court's decision in Maspero points out that that's why there's the obligation under the statute, Texas Transportation Code. No.
Isn't it possible, just for purposes of argument, that if we're to credit Officer Baskin's testimony that he did not see Mr. Taylor, even though he was very carefully inching into the intersection and making sure nobody was coming, that Mr. Taylor would not be able to see or hear him as well? Isn't that a possibility under the circumstances?
Certainly, Your Honor. I think we're assuming that for the purposes of this
appeal.
Okay,
so what I'm really looking for is how we get here as a matter of law, that what he was doing means that there's no waiver of sovereign immunity with regard to the city of Arlington under the circumstances. That was really the purpose of my original question, because when y'all cited the obstruction cases, you've got two different cases here. You've got the slowing and you've got the obstruction cases. But in the citing to the obstruction cases, it's basically cited as some type of legal, premise without saying this is why this fits into those particular cases. Okay. Now, you've argued that there was a vehicle that was blocked, that was stopped, okay, and even though there was a green light, presumably.
Yes.
So it was stopped, and that was an obstruction. But what I don't have is how does that fit into the cases you cited with regard to obstruction? What was the nature of the obstructions in the other cases? Or was it just a general principle that recognizing there might have been an obstruction that is not enough to waive sovereign immunity under the circumstances?
Your Honor, one of the obstructions was a building, and I think that the other ones were vehicles as well, but I would need to double-check that.
Okay.
I don't remember just off the top of my head.
Well, and if I am misremembering myself, then I'll figure that out, and I'll credit you with considering a question that should have not been asked.
I don't know that I'd go that.
But I'll catch it from these two. No, so you'll be vindicated. There's no way around that.
But the cases that involve the obstructions also mention the slowing issue. That's one of the things they talk about in saying that the using lights and sirens and the slowing indicates that the emergency responders in those cases were not acting with conscious indifference or reckless disregard.
Well, it's a totality of the circumstances type of situation. If you've got your lights and sirens on and you just speed through the intersection, you're dead meat in terms of waiver.
Okay? And that's what the case
is.
So
it's a combination of all of these things that what you're doing to indicate effectively the old some care standard to avoid gross negligence is you're showing what care you took, and as long as you're demonstrating what care, then there's no waiver of sovereign immunity.
Yeah, the cases where governmental immunity has been denied have involved either situations where the officers were not using lights and sirens, where they were going in an excessive speed and had not slowed down. Those are really the characteristics of those cases by and large.
I don't think you mentioned it in your brief, and I could be wrong, But I don't think you told us what the courts, what standard of review they typically apply. But I assume it's de novo.
That's correct.
And obviously, if it is de novo, that we have to do a totality of the circumstances analysis ourselves. And of course, to be, I guess why I was asking about you mentioning the other driver in your brief is, it's my understanding we don't, it really doesn't matter because we're just looking at what the officer did or didn't do and determining whether or not the appropriate care was exercised.
No, that's correct, Your Honor. Okay. That would become relevant if the case had been to go to trial or something like that. Certainly the questions of the fact that he wasn't paying adequate attention, didn't notice the lights and sirens, didn't notice the car right next to him that had already stopped at a green light, things like that would become relevant at that point as to any sort of comparative fault, but not as relevant to the issue of Officer Baskin's conduct. That's correct, Your Honor.
You have 3 seconds.
I'll give my 3 seconds back.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Thank you. May it please the court. It occurred to me when I was putting this brief together that when you guys were reading it, you may have had the question to yourself, why did Mr. Lidgey bring this case in the first place? You look at the statute.
I often ask that question with regard to Mr. Lidgey.
I want to speak ill of my other plaintiff lawyers,
but let's focus
on Mr. Lidgey.
You can tell him I said that. So
I will do. The statute seems
but I smiled when I smiled and I laughed when I did.
I did. So, okay. Let the record show. The statute seems to clearly create an emergency exception. The Supreme Court just last year talked about, whenever a vehicle crosses a highway against a light, they're bound to interact with some other vehicles. Sort of seems to be open and shut when you first look at it. But something you just said, Justice Walker, I think is really the key to this case and the key to this appeal. It has to do with what the officer did or didn't do. And here, the crux of this appeal is what actually happened, okay? We have Officer Baskin said he came to a complete stop. The police report said he slowed down, but I never saw him come to a complete stop. The crash investigator said he did not come to a complete stop. So what happened? For purposes of this appeal, it doesn't matter. We just need to know that it's not clear. The only testimony we have is from three people that work for the city of Arlington, and the standard of review is undisputed. It's the same standard of review as we use in a summary judgment, and the testimony of an interested witness has to be clear, positive, direct, credible, free from contradiction, and uncontroverted. Now,
if he slowed down, what difference does it make whether he stopped or slowed down?
Because we don't know what happened. We don't know who's telling the truth.
But if we assume the lowest common denominator, that he only slowed down, does that create a fact issue as to whether he's reckless?
Yes, Your Honor, because we don't know the credibility of someone who's saying that they completely stopped versus the credibility of someone who said they slowed down. And I think that's the crux of this. And as someone who handles a lot of these plaintiff side appeals, this is where it gets very frustrating because this is a plea to the jurisdiction. In other words, the courts don't even have the subject matter jurisdiction to consider the dispute. But I think what the city's arguing here is, but you do have jurisdiction to resolve disputes among our own witnesses. You can decide which one you believe most, and then if it fits into the pattern that allows you to dismiss the case, well, please do so.
And let me interject real quick.
Sure.
Try to hold that thought. Try to remember it. And I may be getting ahead of myself. But we have a task to do a de novo review in this case. We don't have the capacity to see or hear those testifying witnesses like the tri-court did. Typically, when we're applying an abuse of discretion, that's a little bit easier thing for us to do because we can look at what the trial court did and know that they were better suited to figure out, what the witness was, whether it was true or not. But here we have a situation where we've got to apply de novo review, which means we have to look at the record and we have to look at what's there. And, and there's really nothing in the record that I'm aware of that brings up great credibility problems other than argument, really.
You're exactly right. 100%, and I think that's exactly why affirmance is appropriate here. This was not a case where, just like a summary judgment motion, which, why it's not surprising we use the same standard of review, this is not a case where the court had the ability to gauge the credibility of the witnesses. This was entirely on paper. They submitted affidavits and deposition transcripts.
Do we not have the video from? We have the video with regard to the cam from the officers.
We have a video camera, which I believe my last review is not entirely conclusive of whether or not recklessness.
Well, no, I understand. I'll give you an analogy. I had a case when I was on the district court where a gentleman walking into Costco said he slipped in a puddle. Okay? Now, that's an affidavit from him. It's an interested witness. So using the same standards that you would apply under those circumstances, it's not necessarily, you know, it's not conclusive because he's an interested witness. He had a real problem, though, because Costco had a camera right above where he slipped, and in watching the camera, you could see him literally bend down and sit in the puddle. And so you knew that his testimony that he slipped was not supported by actual objective video evidence. Here, I think where Justice Basil's going is we have the case law, and I believe Barnes is to this effect, which is us, so we're bound by Barnes, is that you've got that it doesn't have, that all that has to be done is some type of care, and it doesn't have to be an absolute dead stop before entering the intersection under these circumstances, that slowing is sufficient to show sufficient care under an emergency circumstance, okay? So the argument is whether you believe one or the other, either he came to a stop, okay, or he slowed. And I would credit your argument with regard to it's, you know, not controvertible, but in this fact, it is subject to controversy because we've got the video of it. And the video seems to support at least some degree of, it supports slowing, if not completely coming to a stop. So while you're correct, there may be some credibility issues as to what exactly happened. None of the evidence in the record actually demonstrates that there was a conscious indifference by not doing at least something to recognize the risk involved in crossing the intersection under the circumstances.
Your Honor, I have a couple answers to the question, so give me just a...
Sure.
The example that you gave with regard to the Costco case, that sounds a lot like the very well-cited U.S. Supreme Court case called Scott versus Harris, where it was a civil rights claim where the plaintiff was either injured or killed when he was in a high-speed chase. He was the driver of the vehicle. And if you read his response to the summary judgment motion on qualified immunity, you would have read his affidavit and thought that he was a little old lady driving to church on Sunday. The dash cam from the police department showed that he was going 80 miles an hour, crisscrossing lanes, driving into, you know, he's a madman. And I think it was a Justice Scalia opinion. He said, all right, you know, normally we assume everything the plaintiff says is true, the non-movement says is true. However, when video evidence clearly shows that it's a sham affidavit, then we can disregard it.
Okay, so what I need to hear from you is what demonstrates that the evidence that they're relying on is sham. What you're talking about is insufficient care, which that's not your standard. Your standard is conscious indifference. So what shows anywhere in this record that they were consciously indifferent?
So can I evade your question for 1 second?
Sure.
Before I get back to
it? Only for 1 second.
Well, maybe 30. The problem here, and I think the difference between Costco case, Scott versus Harris, and here, is one was a plaintiff trying to keep the case alive who was clearly lying. The guy sitting in the puddle is the guy that wasn't a little old lady driving to church. Here it's the defendant trying to have the case thrown out. And this is a different standard. You know, under a qualified immunity summary judgment or in a premises liability summary judgment, the plaintiff has some burden to show that he wasn't aware of the danger, or in a qualified immunity case, that it was clearly established law and that there was, you know, et cetera. Here, the burden for a plea to the jurisdiction is to show that all your testimony lines up. It's undisputed as to what happened. And as a result of that, we, of course, don't even have jurisdiction to hear it because when it's undisputed, like it was in the Barnes case that you just referenced, in Frazier, in Spears, in Kuhn, and all the other cases that appellant Skinner cited in their briefing, those are all cases where the facts were undisputed. And so, like your question, Justice Walker, trying to find a case that's exactly on point, like what if he stopped for a second? What if he stopped a little bit? Maybe he kind of rolled. You know, we don't need to try and distinguish the case law to see whether it's closer to Barnes or closer to Frazier. That doesn't matter. My point here is more procedural. This court doesn't get to address the merits of which case it's most like if they're not entitled to the relief in the first place. And this is, I think, the sort of the policy, the substantive argument that I'm really making here, and is that, you know, the interlocutory appeals in the state have really gotten out of hand, whether it's Med-Mal, Tort Claims Act, the anti-SLAPP statute. Everything seems to be able to simply blow up the case and spend 2 or 3 years on appeal before you can get back to the merits.
And this is a point upon which we can agree.
And I come here looking for a way
he
to
he took
make
the
it
words
like,
out of my mouth. I was going to try to be more objective. But
trying to speak to my jury here. But the point being is, an opinion in this case.
There is the one point. I can't let that go. Okay. The problem is this is a jurisdictional issue.
Right.
Okay. It's a freedom to not be sued. It's not a liability issue. It's a do you even get in the door issue. Okay. And so that's different than the Med-Mal context and the TCPA and all this other stuff.
I agree. And I'm surprised Mr. Skinner didn't say it because, frankly, in every immunity case, that's what you hear is not only the freedom from liability, it's the freedom from suit. Well, there's got to be a way to test that. You know, that statute's got to be subject to some judicial review, and that's why we're here.
So are you suggesting that the standard here is if there is not 100% confirmation of all evidence with regard to the jurisdictional facts, that waiver occurs?
What I'm saying
is as long as the plaintiff can say somebody's not being completely truthful or, for that matter, just inconsistent with regard to the recollection, bingo, that's it. So one says, well, the light was yellow. One says the light was green.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is not that waiver occurs. What I'm saying is that if you don't have everybody on the defense side lined up with the same story, and you don't have video evidence that conclusively establishes one of them, and I take a quick side to note that if the video evidence conclusively established it, that would have been a grounds that they moved on in the trial court and emphasized here, and they didn't in either court. And respectfully, you're not entitled to relief that you don't ask for. So that's not an argument they've ever raised. But the point is, it doesn't mean waiver. It means plea to the jurisdiction is the wrong procedural tool to get here. If they wanted to file a no evidence motion for summary judgment, say, show us all your evidence of recklessness, they might get the same result as a plea to the jurisdiction when all the facts line up. But they wouldn't have the interlocutory appeal if it was denied. So in other words, if the governmental entity can't get their story straight, and I don't mean that in any pejorative sense, like they were secretly lying or whatever, but under the circumstances where you have documents, okay, where two people on the government side are saying something different, then you don't file a plea to the jurisdiction. You know, you file a summary judgment motion. Maybe it means someone's subject to a deposition. But so what? If you have two people that work for the government that are telling two different stories, well, then let's get them, put them under oath, and let's figure out why their stories are different. That's what trials are for. That's what discovery is for. And I realize there's freedom from suit, but freedom from suit is when everybody agrees on what happens. That's when there's no jurisdiction.
Okay, you've got to give me some authority with regard to that.
Well, I think
because you're talking about a perfect record. That's mm-hmm. what you're talking about, that everybody testifies that A is A and B is B and C is C. And if there's any digression from that, from anything, then bingo, jurisdiction applies.
I don't think you're going to find a case that says exactly what I just said. Otherwise, I would have said it first as soon as I walked up to the podium. But I think what you will find is if you look in Barnes, Spears, Kuhn, at some point in time in all of those opinions, they use the word undisputed. Okay, it's undisputed that the officer slowed down in Barnes. It's undisputed as to the facts in Frazier. The question in that case was actually whether it was an emergency or not.
Okay, so it's not undisputed here. It's disputed, but what's the dispute? The dispute is stop versus slow. And there's nothing in the record, including the video, to indicate that there was excessive speed or anything of that nature, which would be a true dispute between slow and stop.
Even in a summary judgment context, it has to be a material issue.
Correct. And I think that... Hold on.
And if slowing is sufficient to demonstrate the absence of recklessness, how is the question of whether he came to a complete stop or merely slowed create a material issue of fact?
I think, Your Honor, again, it may ultimately not create a material issue of fact as to recklessness in the summary judgment context. But in a plea to the jurisdiction context, it's just not the right vehicle. You know, and if we even wanted to look at the substance more at this level, which I would disagree with, but even if we did,
was Barnes a plea or was Barnes a summary judgment?
I believe Barnes was a plea. There's a couple of those cases
We're going to have to distinguish. We have to say, this is what we've held before on these circumstances, and what you're suggesting right now is that because the Barnes opinion used the word undisputed, but that the evidence here is. There's some degree of dispute. That's the fig leaf on which we're going to basically say Barnes doesn't really have any application here.
Great.
Okay.
I think, Justice Bassel, one thing to look at here is the statute that they're relying on, 546.001 of the Transportation Code. That's the emergency exception. And it says it allows the operation of an emergency vehicle to proceed past a red light after slowing as necessary for safe operation. So what's as necessary? You know, because we have a dispute as to what actually happened, we don't know what was necessary. Here the driver is maintaining, I came to a complete stop. And when I decided to go, it's because I felt it was just fine. Other evidence suggests he did not come to a complete stop. So how do we know what was necessary if we don't even know what happened? And I think that because this is why, Justice Walker, this is appropriate for a jury issue, because at the end of the day, the jury, or the fact finder, is going to have to determine what was necessary. They're going to try to look at the witnesses and who was lying, the driver, my client, as well as the driver of the
How do we determine as necessary?
Well, Your Honor,
there's no dispute as to where the vehicles were. There's no dispute that the vehicle that had stopped with the green light was stopped with the green light. There's no dispute that vehicle was obstructing the view of both the officer and Mr. Taylor. So we know that that's undisputed, okay. So how do we determine, why can we not determine what was necessary if the facts are that part of it's undisputed?
My answer would be, Your Honor, is when you use how can we determine, first I'd say that this may be an issue for a jury's concern, not necessarily this court. And when a jury reviews it, you're going to look at whether the jury abused their discretion or not. And the reason I come back to that is, if he actually, why did he say he stopped and came to a complete stop and swore under oath that he came to a complete stop if he didn't? You know, a jury might say, the video here doesn't make it look like he came to a complete stop. The police report doesn't say that you did so. The investigation doesn't say that you did so.
So back in the day, when I got a ticket in the mail because we used to have red light cameras, and I'm going, what the heck? And I look at the video, and I'm like, I'm thinking, where the heck is that? Oh, I stopped. And then I look at the camera, and I'm like, oh, well, I didn't stop completely. But, yeah, that's a stop.
So you're saying because the officer may have gilded the lily as to whether he came to a complete stop, that creates a fact issue as to whether he adequately inspected the intersection before he drove through it.
Correct, Your Honor. And if there's a lack of adequate inspection, the question of whether it was necessary, and again, my goal here, my duty here, plaintiff's obligation in response to a plea to the jurisdiction, is not to prove recklessness, okay? It's to show that there's at least a fact question that would otherwise preclude summary judgment on the issue. And that's, I guess, the difference between plea to the jurisdiction and a no-evidence summary judgment motion, is that a no-evidence summary judgment motion can't be considered until there's been opportunity for discovery. And if all of the evidence that came from the government was completely undisputed, all the ducks were in a row, then we have a pure legal question. But here, if we don't actually know what actually happened, we don't have a pure legal question. And so I respectfully submit that an opinion from this court, essentially stating government entities throughout the state, if you don't have everybody in your circle on the same side of the story, don't use this procedural device. You know, use a different one. And that benefits everyone because, first of all, it would allow for discovery in the circumstances where the government agency doesn't have a straight story. Second, it doesn't allow for an interlocutory appeal in the event that the judge were not persuaded that there was a material difference. And I think that's the important thing here, too, is we don't want every single factual dispute in the record to become a question of law for an appellate court. We allow the trial judges to make that determination and then review it for an abuse of discretion. In the event that concludes there is a fact dispute, it goes to the jury, and then it comes up that way.
Just out of curiosity, what discovery were you, concerning jurisdiction were you not able to do in this case? Because all of the plea to the jurisdiction case law says that jurisdictional discovery is always permissible before the court makes a determination with regard to subject matter jurisdiction.
In this case, Your Honor, we're not complaining about lack of discovery. I see I'm almost up. Can I finish?
You can answer the question.
We're not complaining about lack of discovery or the ability to conduct it in this case. What we're saying is because there's a factual dispute, the jury should be allowed to hear the same witnesses just like we did in our depositions. And if they believe one over the other, you know, then that's going to be the resolution of the case. And when it comes up to this court on a traditional appeal, you'll look at it for the sufficiency of the evidence, not trying to parson every single naked factual dispute, record dispute, as to whether this is more like Barnes or more like Frazier. It'll simply be, could a rational jury have reached that conclusion?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your time, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple of things. First, there are two cases that involved the precise issue of whether there was a dispute as to slowing versus stopping. And in both cases, the court's appeals said it doesn't matter because there's no dispute that they at least slowed. Those are the...
What if the officer says, I slowed, I looked left, then I proceeded through the intersection, and somebody hits me from the right?
Oddly enough, Justice Basil, there actually is a case where that something along those lines happened, the Texas DPS versus Sparks case, where the driver says that he slowed, that he looked left. He says that his passenger looked right to clear it. And they went through and got it wrong. And they ended up in an accident. The passenger also said that they had stopped. So he actually had a dispute between the two people in the same car, both of whom worked for DPS, as to the slowing versus stopping. And the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals.
Interested witnesses.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, both interested witnesses, both confirmed that. Now, in our case, we don't just have interested witnesses. Not only do we also have the video, which, you know, is an interested witness, but we also have the testimony of the civilian driver who was at just two cars over, who observed Officer Baskin slow down. He says he came to a complete stop and then proceed slowly through the intersection. So there is a dispute from looking at the video. You're not able to see for sure whether he came to a complete stop. I think Justice Birdwell, you know, made a great point in terms of the red light cameras and the perception of how that can go about in one sense of it. But there's no doubt, no dispute that he slowed down. And it's not in dispute that he scanned the area. They haven't challenged that. They're challenging that he should have stopped. That without the stopping, he was not acting with the appropriate level of care. They also object.
Well, I think I would agree with you in their briefing, but it's a little bit different here today, an argument. And it sounds like to me what the appellee's position is that you have a statute that you're relying on in order to get the benefits of qualified immunity or the immunity swallowed in. And that language is that, this verbiage that's really probative is as necessary. And it sounds like what his position is because all of the evidence is not going all in the same direction, then that as necessary is still a question. That's what it sounds like. And what do you say to that? What's your response to that?
Besides from an argument not made in the briefs, wouldn't have been preserved. But aside from that, there isn't a dispute that he did slow down. And the cases are consistent in saying that slowing down is enough. The stopping isn't necessary. That just the decrease in speed, that alone shows, I mean, unless there's some sort of unusual factor, perhaps, I think there's a footnote in one case where they say, well, you know, we aren't saying absolutely forever, but pretty much if the officer slowed down, that indicates that they were not acting with conscious indifference or reckless disregard.
That's not Barnes, correct?
That's not Barnes, no.
Barnes
is very, very straightforward in just dealing with the lights and sirens and slowing down indicate that, let's see, what does it say? Yeah, at the intersection, Officer Warren slowed down and looked around, then seeing that traffic had stopped or yielded to him, he proceeded into the intersection without coming to a complete stop. Now, as it turned out, he was wrong, and he was in an accident. But it's not a negligence standard here. It's a much higher standard.
Well, we're only dealing with subsections 2 and 4. 2, because you're proceeding past a red light. That is undisputed.
Correct, Your Honor.
And that's where the after slowing is necessary for safe operation.
No, it's the same in Barnes.
That's 2. 4, disregard a regulation governing the direction or movement of or turning in specified directions. Arguably, that's the median going around the cars, but
yes,
that doesn't necessarily seem to be the gist of what they're complaining of.
Yes, yeah, they don't seem to be arguing that at this point. Okay. It was in the petition originally, but they haven't argued that on appeal.
Okay. But those 2 and 4, to that extent, is what y'all are relying on. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
All righty, 2 seconds.
You can have it.
You have been so efficient. Thank you very much. Gentlemen, thank you all for your arguments. If you consider yourself to have been abused a little bit, it was all in good fun and all in good faith. We do appreciate your arguments. We really do.
Both did a very good job.
And thank you for your efforts at bringing enlightenment to the panel. So thank you very much. Your case is submitted, and we will get back with you. Thank you.
All right.